Hello and welcome to
Skeleton Songs.
Remember this?
Didn't we used to do a podcast?
Yeah, we did. We did a podcast and we really liked it and other people liked it. And then we sort of forgot about it because we started doing other things.
We just got really busy making a game.
So our last podcast, as you may or may not know, was in around April 2022, I think. And since then, I wrote a list. We got married.
Oh, yeah.
We had a honeymoon. We launched a game. We had a big fight.
What was the game? Just for those...
Book of Hours. An excellent game about managing an occult library available on Steam and GOG right now. It's fantastic. We had a fight with a printer, which was possessed. Do you remember this?
No, that was a dream you had.
No, it was a printer that any time it connected to Wi-Fi exploded.
Yes.
Nobody knows why.
Yeah.
And then we got another printer, and when that connected to Wi-Fi, that also exploded.
I think the Wi-Fi is possessed.
Anyways, that happened. The lady afterwards got a new version with the mysterious package company.
Yes, it did.
The lady afterwards is our tabletop role-playing game based on Cultist Simulator. So if you're interested in 1920s occultism, that's the one for you, available on our site or on the mysterious package company. We went to Cornwall for research for Book of Hours, where we looked at St. Michael's Mount. And I was very sad to discover that the place where St. Michael's Mount is, which is a town clearly called Mousehole.
Muzzle.
Was pronounced a muzzle.
Muzzle.
Why would you name a place Mousehole?
Cornwall ain't England.
And then call it Muzzle.
Cornwall ain't England. Don't be doing with your English.
Anyway, so we're quite busy.
If you weren't aware of it, St. Michael's Mount was one of the two biggest inspirations for Bancroog, the Isle of Bancroog in Book of Hours. The library on island, the other inspiration, of course, was Mont-Saint-Michel, which is St. Michael's Mount's English twin across the Channel, which actually had an abbey church on it rather than just the St. Aubrey family's castle. Anyway, we thought we'd do our podcast again. We thought we'd pick up where we left off, but where we left off was magic in books and how that sort of overlaps with magic in games.
Yeah, we wanted to look at magic theories in general, because of course this is something that you particularly, AK, have looked into for Cultist and Book of Hours, but Cultist particularly, because that's all about actually being a cult member.
You remember, I nearly called it Occultist Simulator, but it just didn't have the same ring.
Well, the name was very divisive anyway.
It was very divisive. And
should have called it Mousehole. Just putting that one in there.
At Muzzle. And it caused us all kinds of problems when we tried to sell it in America as well, because cult in Britain means the fun sort of literary supper club.
But in America, cult in America means Waco.
Yeah.
Yeah, which wasn't a touchstone, we'll be honest.
No.
No. Okay, so magic.
Yeah. So what are we talking about today?
Well, today we thought we'd go to one of the core literary examples of magic, which also kind of weirdly doesn't have any magic in it, which is kind of the point. So we're talking about Dr. Faustus.
When you say it doesn't have any magic in it?
So, Faustus was a play in the 16th century written by Christopher Marlowe, a fantastic playwright, my favourite. Who is also handsome and great and a spy, and we all love him and he's super great.
Yeah, he's dead though.
He's super dead. He died quite close to us, actually.
He did, he's a local boy.
He is a local boy.
And to be clear, I'm jealous of Marlowe because my wife fancies him despite him being 500 years
and
dead.
To be fair, he is a spitting image of my ex-boyfriend.
I've forgotten that.
I mean, it's weird.
Well, I'm going wee on his grave now.
Don't, he's great. Anyway, Faustus was this...
No, but I can't because he's buried in an unmarked grave in Deptford Churchyard. Yeah.
Which is further adding mystery to the existing mystery of what happened. Anyway... Faustus is interesting because it taps into and is the best known example of a sort of literary description of a very Elizabethan idea, which was magic and the occult was fascinating to lots of people. But was it liberation or was it damnation? Which is actually a parallel that is specifically mentioned in Faustus. Does it add to your knowledge of the world? Does it increase scientific awareness at a time where people were discovering things all the time? Or is it actually a ploy by Satan to pull you away from good knowledge and good life. You know, kind of like the classic biblical story of there's knowledge of good and evil, and maybe we shouldn't have all knowledge. So Faustus, despite being a play explicitly about a scholar who becomes an explicit magician, who does on stage acts of magic, some of the magic that he does, all of the magic that he does, is maybe not the magic you would expect to see if you came to Faustus and the only thing you knew was I'm going to see a play about a really good magician.
Hmm. Yeah, and I think part of that, honestly, is special effects.
But, that's true.
But, of course, the whole conception of magic back then was ceremonial magic. The 20th and 21st century idea of magic being something that came out of your fingers when you say the words was a very modern conception. And one of the things magicians did was call storms, but they never threw lightning bolts.
Mm.
And in a lot of the stuff we've done, we've gone back to something more like ceremonial magic because it lends more of an air of mystery to it. But the liberation and damnation thing,
it's interesting, isn't it?
It is. Do you want to go back to Marlowe himself a minute, because there's some stuff there that ties in?
I mean, there's a lot going on with Marlowe. What particular bit?
So,
do you mean his atheism? Do you mean his membership in what I have now discovered to be the, what is it?
The School of Night.
The School of Night!
I know, right?
So good. Do you want to talk about School of Night? Sounds like something you'd make up.
Well, let's go back further
the
still.
The Night Arts.
To, you said he was an atheist.
Allegedly.
Allegedly, but you know he was also allegedly a Catholic.
Well, it wasn't everyone.
But the whole, but they weren't.
I know. Yeah. So, because it was Elizabeth I, who was obviously super Protestant, and then you probably know this. Famously, there was a bit of a hoo-ha when he was getting his degree. He was basically local boy done good. He came from not any particularly impressive origin that anyone's aware of, and somehow managed to get a scholarship to a very good school and ended up studying at a Cambridge college. I think it was Corpus Christi. So he was doing. He's clearly very clever, and he was clearly going places. But there was some weirdness about him actually getting his final degree, which was allegedly because people were worried that he was going to go off with his new degree to, I think, Reims in France.
It was even more than that. It was that he,
and
I mean,
basically
you're right,
become a Catholic.
So specifically, he'd been absent for unexplained periods.
Right.
And there were stories that he had been about in Europe, particularly in Reims. And there was a Catholic college in Reims. Europe. And you know how he wangled getting his degree despite this?
I think I know, but tell me.
You probably get the same quote I did. So the Privy Council, he actually presented a letter from them. So the Privy Council sounded like they meet in the toilet. But what
have
it
you
means
got a
is,
quote? Because I also looked this up and I love this phrase.
You say it then.
Well, I think this is the phrase. the letter as quoted, because we don't have the actual letter anymore, we only have the moments from meetings in which the letter was discussed. So again, this adds to a layer of mystery around Marlowe himself. The minutes of the meeting in which the letter was discussed say it was not Her Majesty's pleasure that people employed as Marlowe had been in matters touching the benefit of his country should be defamed by those who are ignorant of the affairs he went about.
I didn't have all that. I just said the matters good? Touching the benefit of the country.
The next time someone's like, where were you today? I'll be like, you are ignorant of the affairs I went about.
Yeah, she's been on matters touching the benefit of the country.
Every day.
Did you see the thing about the buttery bills as well?
I was going to mention this. So if you don't know, a buttery, and my college actually had a buttery, which makes us all sound like we're sort of spherical and rolling about eating pies, which was not totally incorrect. A buttery is basically the I don't know.
My wife is slender like a willow tree.
Anyway, it's basically the kitchen, isn't it? It's the refectory. It's the place where all the food is. And the buttery essentially was the place which kept track of students' bills for their food and their snacks and their wine and everything. And the reason that we know that Marlowe, the reason that people suspect that Marlowe might have some secrets is not only was he not getting anything out of the buttery for periods of time, which would imply that he was not at college for long periods of time, which absolutely is a no-no at Cambridge because they're short terms and you have to learn a lot. But when he was there, my God, did the buttery know it? Apparently, he'd spent amazing amounts of money on food and drink, far beyond his means. Is basically this nobody who was clever. So the implication is that somebody was funding him, and the only reason that anyone can think that somebody would fund this, what was he, 23-year-old upstart?
Yeah,
and keep this is red
the,
wine.
One of the eternal truths is that students, unless they have a mummy and daddy
Have no money ever.
Have no money ever. But, no. But mysteriously went on jollies to the continent, then came back and bought out the buttery.
Well, and then when somebody said, you're in trouble, mate, the Queen got involved. Yeah. That was kind of the key. But anyway, we're getting into a sort of fan situation here.
So, but I think, you know, there was never any... nobody's ever sort of come up with a smoking gun letter from Francis Walsingham or anything saying he was a spy. But it's hard to...
There are a lot of unanswered questions.
Yeah. And you know about the arrest warrant before his death?
I don't.
So on May the 20th, there had been scandalous writings apparently found in Marlowe's rooms in which he purportedly denies the divinity of Jesus Christ.
Oh, is this one where he said that, like, John the Baptist and Jesus were gay and, like, Mary was a dreadful woman?
I didn't know those details. I just knew they were scandalous. I knew that there were, like, handbills put up on the street signed Tamburlaine, which, of course,
is very good. Highly recommend Tamburlaine. It's particularly funny because he wrote actually two Tamburlaines. He wrote the first Tamburlaine, and that went down like gangbusters. He was actually the premier playwright at the time, more than Shakespeare. And then, because it was so successful, he wrote Tamburlaine 2. And the opening of Tamburlaine 2, the prologue is literally Marlowe speaking to the audience saying, well, you liked the other one so much, because I'm so great, I've written another one.
You should do that in the third game.
What, with Book of Hours 2?
Yeah.
You schmucks, bought Book of Hours.
I believe the working title for the third game is The Fourth Tomato.
Nobody listening is going to understand that joke.
And yeah, I don't even understand that joke.
That's some sort of obscure reference, listeners, to the fact that we have two very stupid ragdolls who we believe their brains are populated
by cat.
Tomatoes. Anyway, what were we talking about?
We were talking about Marlowe being... So I said May the 18th, May the 20th, I got it wrong. May the 18th, because of all these scandalous things about John the Baptist being Jesus' special man friend and the stuff found in his room.
I think the phrase was something like, he leaned always to his bosom. Seriously.
Well, that's very charming.
It is charming, isn't it?
Anyway, the arrest is issued. He has to. He's summoned before the Privy Council, which doesn't mean he has to go to the toilet. And so, 20th May, he turns up, but there's no Privy Council meeting that day. So they.
There's a scheduling error.
They meet when they're going to meet, and they don't have Outlook.
But why are they summoning people on days they're not there?
Well, when he turns up, they say, okay, you've got to come here every day until their lordships have time to have a word with you, because we don't want to mess about.
That's a ridiculous
system.
So he
goes back to the palace every so often.
Fine, whatever.
And it's not clear whether or not he gets a chance to meet with them, because this happens on May the 20th. And on May the 30th, he gets into a fight, allegedly, over the bill, allegedly, in a boarding house in Deptford, just down the road from where we live, Deptford Green. And he is stabbed. There's a hasty coroner's examination the next day, and he's in the ground on June the 3rd in an unmarked grave in Deptford Courtyard.
The unmarked grave is weird.
It is, isn't it?
I think because I was going to say that these stories about this salacious information that was found in his bedroom and everything, you have to take with a pinch of salt, because he was essentially the sort of Taylor Swift of his day.
He was
incredibly,
huge.
Incredibly popular. And as I'm sure everyone listening knows, you know, the more celebrity one has, the more likely people are to say totally mad things about you. So you know, it could be true, but it could be absolutely not remotely true or based on any reality at all.
There was apparently a... the actual records of the inquest came out a few years ago, and some eminent professor of literature said, oh, well, now we're finally going to put to rest all the nonsense about Marlowe having been murdered for other reasons than a fight over a beer bill. And actually, no, there's lots of other weird inconsistencies, and there's no county coroner where there would have been. And the one detail that's always stayed with me is, allegedly, you know, somebody snatched up a knife and stabbed him immediately above the right eye, which instantly killed him. Now, I'm not a pathologist, but I think it's quite hard to kill somebody by stabbing them above the right eye through the forehead, unless you're stabbing them with a truck.
Oh, because of the bone?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't totally trust 16th century coroner's notes, because it could have gone in the eye socket.
So there were suggestions that there might have been lies about it, or anyway, it's all super
mysterious.
But the key thing is, he was possibly an atheist, possibly a Roman Catholic, almost certainly a free thinker who had his own ideas about, to use your phrase, liberation versus damnation.
And he was actually accused of being a magician by somebody who really didn't like him, but that doesn't appear to have any legs at all. But what, you know, to put it into context, Isaac Newton, he you know, wasn't around at the time, but came in, what, the 18th century. I hadn't realised until relatively recently that he was an alchemist as well as an eminent scientist. So to put that in perspective, the guy that we all know is one of the founding fathers of modern science, which in the modern world is not really considered linked in any way to magic, was also at the same time a genuine practising alchemist interested in transmutation of one material into another, and lots of things that today we very squarely would put in a sort of magical...
And this, I understand, is very much the way that Renaissance occultism worked. It ties back to natural magic, and it ties in the sense of magic that arises from the interaction of the forces of the world, not trees particularly.
Well, and this is specifically what we see in Faustus, then, to get back to the actual text. So the basic premise of Faustus is this scholar, and he eventually summons a demon, Mephistopheles, who grants him these magical abilities and makes this classic Faustian pact that he will give him these magical abilities for 24 years and aid him in all of his spells and ambitions. But when that time is up, he will come to claim Faustus' body and soul. And again, one of the big debates of Faustus is how much of the magic is actually the man Faustus, how much is he actually a magician, and how much is he just a vessel for some magic to flow through, or even how much is he just a dupe and Mephistopheles is really the one doing all the magic. And all of these ambiguities can come out in various ways depending on the staging of the play, but of course, because it was written in 1590 something, we don't have any definitive idea of actually what Marlowe was thinking when he wrote it.
And
the stagecraft,
I remembered one of the key effects is that when Faustus starts out, he says, I'm giving up on divinity and law and medicine and all these lame-o disciplines. Tis magic that has ravished me.
Such a good line.
And he's sort of excited about all the things he's going to achieve. He's going to wall all Germany with brass. He's going to fill the public schools with silk in which the students will be bravely clad. And what he actually does is basically some conjuring tricks, summon up a sexy lady, and turn invisible and pinch the Pope's bum.
I was going to say, doesn't he kick the hat off the Pope?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not heroic magic, is it?
It's not. And this actually gave us something in both Cultist and Book of Hours via your idea. Because do you want to talk about this?
No, briefly? You're a
designer. We were talking about Faustus one night over dinner, as you do.
Should we make a pact with the devil? Should we not?
But which devil? whose soul really? Is it going to be halvesies? And Notty liked the idea of somebody who has... So the whole point about Cultist Simulator is you're not selling your soul in the classical sense, but you're giving up lots that you are or could be in order to achieve a particular, very focused ambition. And Lottie said, "Lol, what if somebody did all that and gave up all that, and they did something completely trivial with magic?" And that's how Franklin Bancroft came about. Just the germ of the idea was: here's this Elizabethan prodigy who's a really talented scholar, a magician, an adept, but basically he summons, what is it, percussigans so they can juggle grapes, and he just sends them to get sort of sherry wine here anymore, nip down to the wine shop and get me.
Trying to impress his witch lady,
and Fiona Ayrshire,
and use magic to sort of make her want to kiss him. And then the grape singer is an explicit homage in Faustus. Faust is asked by an emperor or somebody he's sort of entertaining as essentially a conjurer to do something really impressive, and the best that Faustus can come up with, despite being clearly a brilliant scholar and magician, is I will send one of my fairy spirits around the world and bring back grapes, and the whole thing is grapes in winter for this emperor's wife or whoever it is, and really that's the best that he can do. And Marlowe's writing is often described actually as humanist, which is quite interesting for the time, and I really like this side of it, because magic can be quite highfalutin. If you think about some other famously magical creatures, whether they are actual mythological beings or whether they are Gandalf, they often are not totally knowable. Gandalf, for example, is not actually human, even though he looks like him, particularly when he comes back as Gandalf the White. Spoilers! He's kind of on a different plane, right? Whereas the lovely thing about Faustus is he is so human, and he's so subject to all the same human flaws and behaviours and vices and desires that all of the people in the audience and all of the people listening to this podcast are all subject to. And I love the idea that humanness doesn't get lost just because magic has been introduced.
And last time, you're right, last time we were talking about The Tempest back in 2022. And
just 5 minutes ago.
And obviously,
I'm really sorry, everybody.
Marlowe and Shakespeare are contemporaries, and although The Tempest was written quite some time after Faustus. And
but doesn't the ending monologue explicitly homage Faustus?
Does it?
Well, correct me if I could be getting it wrong here, but the final amazing soliloquy of Faustus, doesn't it end with I'll burn my books? And doesn't The Tempest...
It's not the soliloquy, it's a little bit earlier, but it's the last act.
In Faustus, it is the final
act. In fact, no,
that's what I
mean. Wonder if it is an homage, because it's not burn my books, it's drown my book.
Is it?
Yeah.
Because I know that's
deeper
in The Tempest.
Than Deva Plummet Sound. I'll drown my book. And you're right, of course, at the end of... I doubt we've happened across something new. I'm sure scholars...
No, this is the thing. So we know that Shakespeare...
But Faustus says, you know, I'll burn my books.
That's what I'm saying. So it is burn. So Faustus is burn. And this is what I say.
Prospero's drown. I'm sorry, you're way ahead of me.
I actually am on this score. And there are other instances where Shakespeare does explicitly allude to...
I never made that connection.
...Marlowian things. So, you know...
Well, hot diggity.
Similar people.
Well, I'm glad I brought that up. All I was going to say is that I think Prospero is a much more idealised figure. He's not humanist the same way. He's basically magic space dad.
He's slightly unknowable. He is magic space dad. But then, great description. I think Shakespeare would be happy with that.
Magic storm dad.
But then one of the things that Marlowe is interested in is characters with a strong flaw, which I think probably comes more out of the epic mode. I mean, you can think about, I don't know, Beowulf, for example. Or, I don't know, there's loads of classic... fatal flaw.
Does Beowulf have a flaw?
Not explicitly, but the implication is that there's a whole different podcast. I'm not going to get into that because that will be hours. But for example, the Battle of Maldon, which no one has heard of because honestly it's quite boring, which is another Anglo-Saxon Old English poem, famously has this crux where this famous Anglo-Saxon war hero is winning a battle for this bridge. And ultimately, he is overmowed. That's what he is described as. And this is the kind of moment in the narrative where the success that looks like is about to happen for him and his army falls back, presumably because he sort of tried too much or was overweening. And there's a lot of debate about actually what overmowed is in terms of modern translation, which can change the meaning of the poem a lot, which is why it's interesting. But again, you know, Marlowe is fascinated by this. So if Faustus had been content just to be at his amazing university, just learning literally all the other knowledge in the world, he wouldn't be damned and he wouldn't be torn apart by devils. And equally, Tamburlaine is another story of a man who rises to amazing heights off his own back because he's brilliant in many ways, but again has this fatal flaw of he just wants too much, he's too ambitious, and ultimately that is his downfall.
So this all makes sense, and these all clearly are things that affected Marlowe, but one of the things that occurs to me is that Faustus is basically a bit silly. I mean, the narrative is basically a bit silly. And as
it is.
I'm sure you know, Marlowe based it on the Faustbuch, which is an anonymous collection of folk tales about this trickster vicar who went around Germany, pretending he had the devil in a sack. And did you know, because I didn't until quite recently, there was apparently historical Faust, died in about 1540s. He was a contemporary of Paracelsus, who's much better known and real. And Faust was apparently quite a gifted scholar, but he kept bragging about his magic, so nobody took him seriously. Contemporary of Paracelsus, not also of Martin Luther, just to sort of key in. And the same part of the world as well. They're all based in Germany and sort of point south. But...
brings back the religious thing as well, with the Martin
Luther. It does. But I guess a lot of things in European history go back to the religious thing, really.
That's very true.
16th century.
That is true.
But what I was going to say is the original Faust, you know, we know very little about him, but he was a bit of a figure of fun. And the Faust book, he's explicitly a trickster. And this stuff comes through into Faust because he does literally turn himself invisible and... pinch the Pope's bum, doesn't he, at one point?
Yeah.
And...
hilarious.
And what I was taught at school that seems not to have been the case is that... Do you want to talk about the A text and the B text?
Oh my God, I was waiting for you to ask me to talk about the A text and the B text. So, we don't have any... nothing from that time, nothing from the Elizabethan era is sort of confirmed. The way that playwrights used to write plays is they'd have what they called foul papers, something like that, foul-y papers. And they were basically what the actual writers scribbled down on. And they would, you know, write the play. And then they stepped away. It's not like a modern playwright. They had no control over the staging, and they had no control over any what anybody did once they'd given the script to the person who ran the theatre. So this meant that there are lots of scenes that are added in by at a later date by the person who owned the theatre rather than the playwright. So a lot of Shakespeare scholars spend a lot of time justifying why some of the less funny scenes or less well-written scenes in Shakespeare were definitely not written by Shakespeare, but they probably were. And in the case of Faustus, for example, we have two different texts that scholars have totally torn themselves to bits over, trying to decide which one is more true to Marlowe's original, because they differ quite a lot. It's quite unusual to have two versions of one Elizabethan play, which varies so significantly. And the big significance is the A text, which I think is broadly considered the more representative one, purely because it is the older one, so it was closer to when Marlowe was actually alive and writing, whereas the B text, I think, was sort of 1616-ish, and A text, I think, is like 1596 or something. The B text is a third again longer than the A text, and it is actually really grisly. It takes out quite a lot of the ambiguity. One of the famous differences between the A and the B text is there's a line in it somewhere which says, you know, Faustus will be saved if he can repent, which is changed in the later edition to Faustus can be saved if he will repent, which obviously is a very small linguistic change, but huge in terms of Faustus the character's volition. You know, is he actually, you know, and that plays into bigger discussions about the grace of God and the religious stuff. But the ending of the B text is really grim. I mean, it explicitly says that devils come on stage and rip him limb from limb, and then the scholars who are friends with Faustus, and we met at the start of the play, who have constantly been saying to him, like, don't do this, stay away from magic, it's bad for you, come in and are like, gosh, look at all that gristle and bone, isn't that grim? And then the curtain falls. So it's a really nasty, classic kind of bloodthirsty Elizabethan ending.
So what I was taught at school that seems to have been overturned and then unoverturned and then overturned in the 30 years since I was at school.
It's because nobody knows.
is that basically the A text is the slender version that Marlowe originally wrote, and then some prole came along and put all the stuff about pinching the Pope's arse and about the clowns running up and down crying.
With absolutely no facts, I feel determined that Marlowe was into that.
Yeah, well, I you know, like I say, a scholar just absorbed it, but I'm as a total non-literature scholar, fully in agreement, not least because all the source material that Marlowe obviously knew well is all about Faustus playing ridiculous, Faust playing ridiculous magic tricks, and it is this trickstery thing, which fits oddly with the very learned gentleman we see at the beginning. And the... if I remember correctly, all the grisly stuff about being torn into tiny pieces was in the Faust book as well. There's a sort of there was this terrible noise in his lodgings at the night, and then when people dared to poke their head around the door, there's all bits everywhere, and
yeah,
it looks
exactly,
like the
exactly.
aftermath of a quake death match.
Grim, and you know that the violence is sort of shocking to a modern audience, but you also have to couch this in the religious leanings of the time. And if everyone truly believed in God, which basically people did, and you're watching this and you've literally seen a scene where actual devils actually come and actually drag someone and tear them limb from limb and drag them down to hell, I mean, that's really profoundly horrific. That's one of the big themes that scholars get interested in Hamlet, for example, that when he sees his father's ghost, most modern audiences think, oh, it's a ghost, you know, that's interesting, whatever. But again, remember that play was written at the end of the 16th century, where whether you were Protestant or Catholic basically meant that if you saw a ghost, it was either potentially a message from God. That is not a ghost, that is one of our rag dolls, Chi. Yeah, the difference between Hamlet's father's ghost was either that he was a message and who was going to help the main character, who was good, or that he was literally the most frightening thing in the world because he was an envoy from the underworld and was sort of antithetical to God and really frightening. And we sort of lose that angle in the modern world.
And that I think you're right, and that I think keys back to the damnation versus liberation thing, because one of the besetting interests of scholars was, if there's something supernatural happening, where does the power come from? Either it comes from up there, or it comes from down there, or it's the operation of forces of the natural world, and it's all sort of not necessarily divine, but certainly benign.
So where does the power come from in Cultus Simulator?
Well, so in Cultus Simulator, there's the glory and there's nowhere, which are the closest things really you'll get to heaven and hell, but they're I've just stolen bits of motifs from Christianity, from the glory, and Nowhere has really nothing to do with the Christian version of hell. It's a lot like Mictlan, the Central American vision of miserable nowhere hell. But one of the things that I wanted to address in Cultists, and I think it came through quite well, is that if you devote your life to studying this stuff, then it's worth it if you think it's worth it. Mm. So sure, you know, if you're a forge long, you can punch holes in walls and people. But if you put all that ingenuity to work, becoming rich or powerful or famous in the more traditional way, maybe you'd be just as powerful. Even if you couldn't punch holes in walls, you'd have people who could do it for you.
Mm.
Or maybe you'd be happy.
Mm.
And this is one of the things, whenever you're doing setting design for a contemporary fantasy setting, one of the questions that you have to answer is, well, if magic works, why isn't the president of the US doing it? And one of the potential answers he's got, you know, the secret magic service, and another is there's a sort of veil which prevents it happening.
I had never thought of that question. It's a really good question.
It's the kind of thing that nerds and system-oriented types get very, very focused on. So there's bits of all of this in Cultists. There's Calyptra, which is the law and or entities that keep things under wraps. There are mortal agencies that keep things under wraps. One of the biggest things is just, why would you want to? So if you want to become a lantern long, sure, you're immortal, but you have to spend some time eating people's brains, and then you lose access to your body, and you only exist in a sort of dreamy afterlife.
Mm.
And then at some point, probably something will eat you, because the man says the dreamy afterlife is quite a miserable place. So I wanted this sense that it's you know, as with Faustus, you can surrender all you are for something, and maybe it's worth it and maybe it's not. It's you who decides whether or not it's worth it.
Again, it's back to liberation or damnation.
Yeah.
And you seem to fall on more of the damnation side, I think. Not in the kind of religious way, but your games, even the mechanics, you know, because you correct me if I'm wrong here, but you specialise in resource-based narrative stuff, which means essentially that you're constantly giving up one thing to get another thing. I've often found, because I'm a pretty, like, chill gamer. Like, I don't enjoy games which are particularly... not difficult, but games that
we talk a lot about
heart
players versus winter players.
Exactly, and if anyone is listening who hasn't played our games, those are two different. Don't chat with me if this is wrong. Like magical aspects or representations of the system, the schema of magic, which we're going to come back to shortly. And winter represents sort of this harsh, also beautiful kind of ending that has no mercy, sort of merciless, like this is just the way things are, and we're very clear about that. And heart is representative of, you know, this ongoing joyous but also quite frightening life beat of the world. And I'm very much a heart player, in as much as, like, I don't really want to be faced with a really horrible choice in a game, whereas I think you, as more of a winter player, really enjoy the sort of, like, difficult decision making.
I do. Well, the Book of Hours mellowed me a lot.
Book of Hours is our first nice game.
Yeah.
I'm very proud of that. But we did want to talk about magical schema, because you always make me laugh when you talk about what you often don't like about magic in games.
Is this the doing a big spell?
This is what we critics call doing a big spell, yes. Would you like to discuss?
I can't remember which particular rant you're trying to provoke, honestly. I think it's that magic in narrative works best when it's not totally explained. If it's unexplained, then it's just deus ex machina, and it's dei, my fucking Latin grammar is always rusty, but it's just no more interesting than "and it turned out to be all a dream." But if the whole thing is beautifully explained, then it's just physics. And there can be a joy in that. I've read a lot of very good fantasy novels with very well worked out schemas. But somewhere in the middle, you get a view of it as being an energy like electricity or gravity, but in sort of squishier than electricity or gravity. Because if you want to make electricity run through things, you can't just put a bunch of wires end to end and say, go through it. But there's a squishy or even lazy way of representing magic in a narrative and in games where you just do a lot of sort of general things. You go, like you're really constipated and the power flows through you and there's a big explosion. And then the strings swell, and the drums beat, and then all the lights go out and it's somebody's done a big spell.
I mean, you have to describe Stranger Things, I'll be honest.
Well, but I haven't, because Stranger Things, again, I think is people can't decide to make things happen just by desiring to make them happen. And often, the doy a big spell kind of thing is
well, 11 can.
A way for... That's true. No,
that's what I meant.
You're right. That's fair. But they've done a lot of work to make it feel satisfying. And often it's the equivalent of somebody saying, "Oh, we'll fill in this bit later for exactly how it works." Mm. And if we do enough Storm and Drang around it, enough of a light show, then people know it's a big magic and it will be okay. And the more details you provide about why it works or doesn't work, the more interesting it can be. But, you know, there's a reason all this stuff goes into narratives in the first place. Part of it is people like a big old spell. There's this general idea of something sort of electrical and exciting happening, and there's music playing, the people.
You're right.
You provoked me into snootiness, which isn't really fair.
No, it's not snooty. I think what you're talking about is a sort of medium incompatibility, because what are the... correct me if I'm wrong here, but one of the more popular examples of magic in literature that everyone says is a really good example of a magical system done really well is Wizard of Earthsea, because we've got enough information about how it works, which is to do with language and knowing people's knowing things' true names, and there being a sort of synchronicity with nature, and there being kind of wisdom based, knowledge based maturity of like being able to like command otherwise natural
forces. And you
get
specifics. They say, so the old powers live in the earth, but they have nothing to do with the sea.
By the way,
the Earth set the story set in an archipelago. So as soon as you've got that, you've got a whole bunch of affordances and possibilities and obstacles and opportunities that arise naturally from there.
It's really juicy and attractive. So I think absolutely, it turns out everyone was right and Ursula Le Guin was great. But my point is that what you've talked about is essentially, you know, trying really hard and doing a big fireball. Imagine that being written in a novel. That's a very boring novel. I mean, certainly if you've ever written any creative writing, anyone who's listening to this, when I've been writing stuff and I've been thinking, should there be a sort of action scene here? Like, the man swung a sword and then the man dodged and then another man swung a sword and then it hit him and it hurt. Like, it's not, I would say, the most interesting part of a book to read, an action scene. Whereas in a game, a lot of it is the visual effect of a fireball. It looks really cool and makes the player feel cool and it's an enjoyable attack to do. So that has a place in games that doesn't immediately make sense in a novel. And equally, most games are based around combat. So if you had the percentage of a book that devoted to combat that you get percentage of a game devoted to combat, it might be the worst book that's ever been written.
And this, of course, is one of the reasons why, quite reasonably, we've moved to magicians working more or less like superheroes in games, because it's very hard... in the traditional sort of Gygax DNA RPG, to do anything like ceremonial magic, where you have some interesting smells and some interesting talk, because everyone else has to do something at the same time. And if you're playing a game, then unless it's a game like, like Cultist, obviously I'm stuck thinking of my own game as the example, but there are other games where you are doing... So off-stage magic on stage, basically. But generally, people want something interesting to happen now, so you have a light show, which is good, which is fun. You know, I've spent a lot of time playing Diablo and dropping meteors.
Yeah, don't get us wrong. Like, I bloody love games where I get to fling magic at people. And this brings us back to a dichotomy that we were talking about a few weeks ago in terms of what we want to do with our games and how our games fit into the larger world of gaming, which is basically they don't, because we do weird stuff. We were talking about...
We're in the kitchen. Everyone else is doing the world of game in the living room. We're in the kitchen by the fridge.
Exactly. We were talking about how games essentially fall into two categories of making people feel one of two things. And they either make the player feel powerful or they make the player feel clever. And obviously that's a massive simplification. I'm sure everybody listening to this right now is like, no, I can think of these examples which are wrong. But just stick with me here. I think it's an interesting sort of thought experiment. I would say that the kind of magic schema that says you have learned level 10 fireball, you can destroy your enemies and set fire to France, makes you feel powerful, but it doesn't make you feel clever, because what you have done is put experience points into the skill of fireball, and now you've got a really powerful fireball. So that's sort of Diablo. And at the end of Diablo, you do feel like a god, and you do, in fact, kill gods. So, lo and behold, that feels very clunky and delicious. Spoilers. And you like it. Spoiler. But there are other games where you feel clever. So those might be games where you have to figure out something on your own, or you have to put the pieces together narratively, or you have to actually solve puzzles in the game. Or in things like Cultist Simulator and Book of Hours, you have to figure out what the hell you do in the first place and then figure out the sort of subtle combinations that actually progress through the game. So I would say that our games aim much more for making people feel clever. And this, again, goes back to Faustus, that which one is Dr. Faustus in the text? Is he a powerful magician? Or is he a learned scholar who has actually, in the same way that people learn algebra and, you know, French and geography, has now just added, I learned magic to that actual scholarship?
So I think in the world of the play, if I remember correctly, he does all this shouting and waving his arms about. Mephistopheles turns up and he says, you didn't really need to do all that, mate. Anytime you pray devoutly to the Prince of Hell, we'll turn up and make a deal. But then Mephistopheles says a lot of things which may or may not be true.
Yeah, can't trust a devil.
No. And that was one of the things I was going to say earlier, is that there are numerous occasions where Faustus asks him for something and he won't give it.
Yeah, he says no, doesn't he?
So bring me a wife. And he's like, no, you know, for marriage is but a ceremonial toy. I'll bring you a sexy devil instead. And
doesn't he ask for like all the knowledge in the world, and he brings him one book?
Yeah.
And again, I love this, because not only is it interesting in terms of, you know, what's going on and what's meant and how the audience takes it, but it's also clearly pragmatism.
Yes.
If you are a playwright, are you going to be more popular with the person in charge of props if you say stage direction he brings them all the books in the world, or he brings them one book? And no, as a producer, I love that.
And as a writer, I literally hadn't thought of that. Of course, you're right. Anyway,
what's your magic in games specifically? Moving away from literary stuff, can you think of magic in games that you've really enjoyed? Give me your favourite example of magic that made you feel powerful and magic that made you feel clever.
I think magic that made me feel powerful probably is a dear old master of magic from way back in the day, and its descendants, things like the Age of Wonder series, where you are a wizard off in a tower, and you are spending a long time at sort of civilization turn-based speeds, gathering power and learning spells. And then also you can unleash them on the battlefield, so you actually see things falling from the sky, or monsters running around, or whatnot. And the whole thing feels like it's happening on a world scale. Magic that makes you feel clever. I'm drawing a blank.
Me too.
I know.
It's tough.
I'm absolutely confident I've played other games, and Cultist is not the only game that does this. But obviously it's unusual in its approach, which is one of the reasons I did it as an experiment. So comment on the YouTube comments, folks, and
yeah, I genuinely like to know
what the hell, because they clearly are, but I'm just drawing a mental blank. It's the Japanese flu.
Yeah, we have brought back, well, Alexis brought back a rather virulent cold from our recent honeymoon to Japan, which is currently destroying us.
Yeah.
But here we are, alive, just.
Yeah, so if by the time you listen to this, then there's like the radio is playing nothing but martial music, and there's a map on the wall somewhere with red stains spreading over Western Europe. It was me, sorry.
It's all AK's fault, yeah.
Well, I think we haven't established whether it's damnation or liberation, but then I'm told that literature is not about giving people the answer.
It's true.
As far as you can tell, it's a way for middle class kids to take up taxpayers' funds at universities. They get that right.
Nonsense. But I would advise all listeners not to make pacts with devils, like, just as a general rule for life. That's a good one.
Even really hot devils. You remember what Faustus says when Mephistopheles brings him a devil on stage?
What does he say?
He says, "Ooh, here's a hot whore indeed."
Oh.
I know.
I mean, I think the point...
And I wasn't really sure what he meant by it. Did he mean... Was he actually excited? Was he no, saying something sly?
Okay, so I think there are two things going on, and I think it's sad. So, he wants a wife, which is sort of pathetic.
Mm.
That's not something that, you know, Gandalf doesn't say, gosh, I'm really lonely, I want someone to talk to and do the crosswords with on a Sunday. Gandalf says, I'm literally, you know, the Maiar, so get out of the way. And I think it is Mephistopheles being deliberately anti-church and shocking, because when he says marriage is a stupid ceremony for losers, obviously quite a lot of church doctrine is about how important it is to get married and not have any sex, unless you're married. Mm. So that's, I think, what that is about. And then when Faustus is excited by seeing whatever devil-ess is summoned up, he's being lascivious, and it's not his wife, and the impression is they're going to, you know, have sex, and it's all going to be anti-church and naughty. And then, of course, remember that in the final act, when he is terrified of ultimately his comeuppance, he, just before his beautiful soliloquy, he asks again for Helen of Troy. He wants to see Helen of Troy. I think it's the last thing he asked of Mephistopheles, and I think Helen was the person he asked for initially. So he's got a real thing for Helen, and of course, I think it's Faustus where we get the famous "Resist the face that launched a thousand ships" quote. And there's something sort of elegant and scholarly about particularly asking for this Greek mythological beauty, which has connection to lots of other interesting things. He doesn't say, you know, I really fancied Suzanne when I was 10, so could I get Suzanne, please? He says specifically the sort of famous, impossible beauty from scholarship and antiquity. And of course he doesn't get her, although I think she passes by in a mask in a sort of liminal, sad way. And then he's dragged to hell. So I think that's what that's about. Very sad. Poor lonely Faustus.
Yeah. Magic kids, not even once.
Well, thank you for listening. We're going to try and do this more often again. I think we did a weekly cycle before, so let's see if we can do that again. We're going to do a couple more episodes. It is ambitious, but what we take away from Faustus is that ambition is always good. I think that's the official take.
And we were working silly hours to get Book of Hours out the door, so now it's out of the door.
And we can't get married again. No. That's happened.
Just to avoid confusion, we got married last year, if anybody's trying to put timelines together. Then you're weird. Put down the red twine. We got married last year. We're going to go on honeymoon in Japan, but Japan was still closed because of COVID. So we gave it a year and then went back.
Yeah, yeah. But we don't have that excuse anymore, so we do have to get back to the grindstone.
Yeah.
All right, well, I believe this is the point where I say, have a spooky day, and we will return with more games and magic soon.
It is magic that has ravished me. Thank you.